Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Kevin Rudd back. I think it's about Mr. Rudd's fourth appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's been a good supporter of the Sydney Institute over the years, and we're very grateful for him being here. I'll introduce him very briefly. He was, of course, a career diplomat. He worked in the Queensland Public Service. He worked as the China consultant with KPMG, MHR for Griffin since 1998, had a number of prominent shadow minister portfolios, including, of course, foreign affairs, but leader of the opposition since December 2006. I think Mr. Rudd was last year, about September last year, and gave a very important speech on foreign policy, but now, of course, he's Labor leader. The speech for tonight is Fresh Ideas for the Future Economy, Confronting the Challenges of Workforce Participation, the Cost of Living and Childcare. Kevin Rudd, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jerry, and thank you all for coming along. It's always a pleasure to speak here at the Sydney Institute, and I'd like to thank Jared and Anne for inviting me along once again. I don't think I've disgraced myself on previous occasions, but the night is still young. The Institute has long been an indispensable part of Australian public life. Just about every debate of consequence is aired in this place at some stage or other. Some ideas are generated here, some are elevated here in the general discourse, and some, like the subject I'll address tonight on workforce participation, cost of living and childcare, take on new shapes as a consequence of these debates. The Liberal Party's principal philosopher in residence, Tony Abbott, concluded recently that in Australia today there are two parallel universes. One universe in which the government appears to be travelling very badly. And then, according to Mr. Abbott, there's the other universe, the real universe. To quote Mr. Abbott, the universe of the substance of government where we have been extremely good, unquote. One of the nice things about Mr. Abbott is his strong predisposition for understatement. His core proposition, however, is that this country has no real economic problems, that we are blessed with first-class government, and the only real problem is that working families just don't get it. The political arrogance of this statement is breathtaking in itself, the economic triumphalism which underpins it even more so. But the level of disconnect which now exists between the universe, Mr. Abbott's term, which the government inhabits, and the universe which working families inhabit, has now become so wide that in fact it's the government that just doesn't get it. The truth is, after 11 years in office, the government has now lost touch with working families. It is led by a Prime Minister who only a few months ago said, working families in Australia have never been better off. Working families in Australia have never been better off. And by inference, that these working families should be grateful for what this extremely good government has given them. Unfortunately for the government, working families no longer believe them, for the simple reason that the statistical averages don't reflect the day-to-day realities that so many families face. The Australian people are remarkably well informed. They follow much more of what goes on in Australian political life than most politicians wish to give them credit for. When it comes to the government's grandiose claims about economic management, the Australian people have reached three basic conclusions. First, that the government has grossly exaggerated its own role in creating the conditions for Australia's current prosperity. Second, that the government glosses over a number of core deficiencies in our nation's overall economic performance. And third, that the government conveniently ignores the fact that while the national economy continues to grow, the household economy is characterised by the realities of declining household affordability and mounting costs of living pressures, both exacerbated by the government's unfair industrial relations laws. After 16 years of economic growth, it is right to ask ourselves why it is now harder and harder for a family on average wages to buy a normal family home in a major city? Why are working families struggling with the escalating cost of groceries? Why is quality childcare less accessible and less affordable than it was a decade ago? And what's the purpose of prosperity when you find yourself less and less able to spend time with the kids through their growing years? Mr. Howard has forgotten the link between the macro picture and the micro experience of working families. The reason we engage in economic reform is both to build the nation and to better working people's lives. Let me now turn to the foundations of Australia's current prosperity. In Mr. Abbott's parallel universe, the Australian economy was a basket case until the Liberal Party was elected in 1996. Unfortunately for Mr. Abbott, this analysis simply is not believed outside of Liberal Party circles. In fact, it is not universally believed within Liberal Party circles. Whether you read former Reserve Bank Governor Ian Macfarlane's Boyer lectures from last year, or you read the reports of the Productivity Commission, or you read the analyses published by the Treasury, the message is clear that the economic reforms of the Hawke and Keating years laid the foundation for the resurgence of the modern Australian economy. This reality is neither understood nor acknowledged by Mr. Howard and Mr. Costello, or, more disturbingly, it is understood by Mr. Howard and Mr. Costello and simply deliberately ignored. The other problem with the Liberal Party's parallel universe is that it seeks to deny the central role of external economic factors in driving much of Australia's prosperity in recent years. The Australian community gets that we are in the middle of a global economic boom, that Australia is located in the epicentre of that boom with the rise of China and India within our own region, and that the world at present has an almost insatiable demand for Australian commodities. The facts speak for themselves. As Reserve Bank's bulletin noted in April, the past century has only seen two booms comparable to the current mining boom, during the 1930s and again in the 1970s. The Reserve Bank Governor, Glenn Stevens, recently noted that the terms of trade boom is delivering an economic bonanza to Australia worth 8% of the value of our economic output this year alone, for around $80 billion. The other part of Australia's current economic reality, which is well understood by the Australian community, is that all commodity booms eventually come to an end. Just as they understand that the role of a prudent government, like that of a prudent family, is how do you best prepare for a future when the external conditions are not nearly so kind. Saul Eslake's analysis indicates that just 8% of the revenue windfall from the mining boom will be spent on education and innovation, just 6% on roads infrastructure. Saul Eslake's conclusion, and I quote, "I have to confess that I genuinely struggle to think of anything of lasting value that has been done with it," meaning the revenue proceeds from the mining boom. And for Labor, as the alternative government of Australia, this represents the core economic challenge for the future and represents the central organising principle of Labor's economic platform for government, namely, how do we build long-term prosperity for this economy once the mining boom is over? The truth is, Australia's economic performance is also not as rosy as Mr. Howard would make out. Take, for example, interest rates. We've had 8 back-to-back interest rate rises over the past 5 years. We've had 4 such rises since Mr. Howard promised at the last election to keep interest rates at record lows. We now see, under Mr. Howard, Australia with the second highest home mortgage rates among advanced economies. We all know that it's not Mr. Howard's call, that is what interest rates are. It is Reserve Bank's call. Then there is the Prime Minister who proclaims his success in creating jobs. It's worth noting that average annual employment growth under the Liberal Party has been 2%, lower than the 2.2% when Labor was in power. Australia also today has a further 500,000 people who are underemployed. They work for less than full-time hours per work and would like to work more hours, equating to an underemployment rate of 5.0%. When added to our unemployed, what the ABS defines as our labour force underutilisation rate is 9.3%. Then there is the skill shortage that is holding back our economic growth, a chronic skill shortage across much of the economy. If ever there was evidence of policy failure, it is here. For its part, the Reserve Bank has been warning of the consequences of skill shortages for a decade or so. But the record demonstrates that these warnings have fallen on deaf ears. To skill shortages, we should add infrastructure deficiencies. The government's response is to blame the states, and when that doesn't work, to blame the states again. A bit difficult when broadband, for example, is a uniquely federal responsibility. And according to the OECD report earlier this week, we have the second slowest and one of the most expensive broadband networks in the developed world. Another source of unease in the mind of the broader community and a number of commentators is why, in the face of the global commodities boom, we are continuing to generate trade deficits, very large current account deficits, and ballooning foreign debt, all under the decade-long stewardship of these self-proclaimed first-class economic managers. Our current account deficit is entering its fifth year above 5% of GDP, resulting in an enormous surge in foreign debt, which now totals $532 billion, in contrast to the $180 billion that Mr Howard promised to reduce back in 1996. Finally, we've also seen a structural decline in Australia's productivity growth. The outcome that more than anything else determines long-term living standards. Over the five-year productivity cycle from 1993-94, market sector labour productivity grew at an average annual rate of 3.3%. But in the 5 years from 1998-99, productivity growth slumped to just 2.1% per annum. According to the National Accounts data, productivity growth also appears to have deteriorated further since then, averaging just 1% in the first 3 years of the current productivity cycle. And in the year to March 2007, productivity growth registered only 0.9%. Which is why institutions like the Reserve Bank, the Productivity Commission, and business groups like the BCA and the Australian Industry Group have been raising productivity growth as a critical challenge for Australia over a very long period of time. Returning once again to Mr. Abbott's parallel universe, Mr. Howard and Mr. Costello are saying that because we are in the midst of a once-in-a-generation mining boom, a budget surplus, and low levels of formal unemployment, that the anxieties felt in working families are therefore misplaced. The argument, in short, is that the government's record is much misunderstood. Our argument, by contrast, is that the government's record is in fact very well understood by working families. The figures that Mr. Howard and Mr. Costello swagger about are not the same figures that make working families worry day and night about the cost of living. The figures that make working families worry are figures like a 53% increase in petrol prices over the last 5 years, a 25% increase in bread prices, increases of between 20 and 60% for butter, and increases of 35% for fruit and vegetables. Increases in general health, hospital and medical services costs have averaged close to 6% a year during Mr. Howard's time in office, two times the official rate of inflation. Preschool, primary and high school education costs under Mr. Howard have increased an average of 7% per year, 2.5 times the rate of inflation. And on home mortgages, since 1996, the average mortgage repayment to income ratio for a typical first home buyer has risen from 17.6% to a staggering 30.7%, and fully 2% more than when interest rates peaked back in 1989. Now, 1 in 4 mortgages are officially categorised as being in mortgage stress. Adding to the government's losing touch with working families and the cost of living pressures is work choices. According to the government's own data from May last year, 100% of all the AWAs took away at least one protected award condition, 63% of all agreements removed penalty rates, 52% removed shift work loadings, and 46% cut public holiday payments. Yet all Mr. Howard can say is that Australian working families have never been better off. Australia needs now a debate on how best to secure long-term prosperity for Australia once the mining boom is over, and without throwing the fair go out the back door. Of course, sound economic management starts with the right framework for macroeconomic policy. But let's not have a false debate about this. On fiscal and monetary policies, the reality is that there is a broad bipartisan consensus, as the former Reserve Bank Governor Ian Macfarlane argued so clearly in his Boyer lectures on the search for stability last year. Mr. Macfarlane said, "These days in the macroeconomic policy proposals of the two major parties are almost identical. The truth is, both major parties are committed to the 2 to 3% inflation target and an independent Reserve Bank, the framework set up under Labor in the early 1990s and formalised by the government in 1996. Both parties are also committed to sustaining budget surpluses over the economic cycle. Labor's budget rules also make the commitment that we won't raise taxation as a share of GDP, and we will reprioritise government spending to offset Labor commitments. Where we differ is in our policies in addressing Australia's future economic challenges. That's why we've been focusing on how we can restore strong productivity growth to Australia and lift participation rates, the key components of what Dr. Ken Henry of the Treasury describes as the three P's: population, participation and productivity, the long-term determinants and drivers of economic growth and therefore improved living standards for working Australians. This is why we, as the Alternative Government, have been laying out a new productivity agenda for the country: human capital investment through what we describe as an education revolution, infrastructure investment starting with a comprehensive national audit by Infrastructure Australia and investing in a national high-speed broadband network to the tune of $4.7 billion. Promoting innovation by building a culture of research and innovation right across this country and through its research institutions in particular. Ensuring that we encourage enterprise by rolling back the tide of excessive business regulation and preparing the global shift for a more carbon-efficient economy. With an ageing population, as described in the government's own intergenerational reports, much of Australia's growth potential rests on boosting both productivity and participation. Tonight, I want to focus in particular on the participation challenge. When you analyse the data, three cohorts stand out in terms of the need to boost participation. One, our young kids who neither study nor work. Two, women who leave the workforce to have kids. And three, older Australians who still have much to contribute towards the wealth generation of our economy and as members to the members of the workforce and as mentors to many still in the workforce. That's why I've already engaged so heavily in what we describe as the education revolution, in lifting retention rates, giving our young kids new pathways, particularly through the trades, to participate in study and work. I'm haunted by the figure that 540,000 Australians aged between 16 and 24 are neither in full-time study, training or work. What a complete waste. Another key component of the participation equation is women's engagement with the workforce. Women's workforce participation has increased steadily over the last 25 years, with the proportion of those aged 15 years and over rising from 40% in 1979 to 53% in 2004. Much of the increase has been in part-time work as women attempt to balance careers with family commitments. Full-time employment of women aged 25 to 34 has also increased markedly, from 29% in 1979 to 44% in 2004. This participation has been underpinned in part by Labor's education funding, opening up access to university for a whole generation of Australian women. And it is clear that improvements in participation have also been facilitated by Labor's childcare reforms. The Whitlam government introduced Commonwealth funding for childcare back in 1972. The Keating government introduced the childcare rebate in 1994, and by 1995-96, childcare expenditure as a proportion of GDP had doubled. But decisions about balancing work and career with the vital task of raising children are ultimately ones best made by parents, not by governments. But that does not remove the responsibility of government to facilitate the work and home careers of Australian parents. For many mothers, returning to work is a choice, but for many others, it is an absolute financial necessity. In so many families, both mum and dad have to go to work to pay the mortgage. It's a tough decision, but to pay the mortgage, you have to pay for childcare. Both costs, mortgage costs and childcare costs, are rising. In this way, families find themselves stuck on a seemingly unending financial treadmill. Parents feel frustrated and often guilty because they have less time with their children and less time with each other. And when they have less time, they often become tired and irritable. I certainly have. This is the reality of modern working life and of a great many working families across our country. Furthermore, traditional family support structures are not as accessible as they once were. Though these days many grandparents are making the sacrifice to be close to their grandchildren to help their own children cope with the constant juggle between work and family life. Grandparents have always been providers of childcare, But over the last 11 years, Australia's grandmothers and grandfathers have been called upon to take an even greater role because of the financial pressures placed on children. We know this to be a fact, as the 2006 census shows that more than 511,000 Australians over the age of 55 are providing unpaid childcare for children other than their own. For many, many Australians, childcare is a critical variable in making the decision to re-enter the formal workforce in some capacity. With childcare a critical part of the work-family decision, the three critical concerns that our families have are, first, is childcare available? Second, is childcare affordable? And third, will my son or daughter get quality childcare when they go into care? Accessibility to childcare is raised by families right across our country. It's hard to find the right information on where places are available, when they are available, and how good the care provided is. Yet the Minister for Family and Community Services is often heard denying both the problems of supply and affordability of childcare. This jars with the experience of working families right across Australia. Indeed, Minister Brough told the Federal Parliament recently, and I quote, "There is no shortage of childcare for the 0-2 age group, preschool age, or any other age," unquote. Tell that to parents right across our country, struggling to find a childcare place for their son or for their daughter. One that is easily accessible to them, one that they have confidence in, one which is flexible enough to meet their particular employment needs. I have a simple practical challenge for Mr. Howard. Provide parents with reliable, location-specific information on the type of care available, by location, the number of places currently available in that location, the cost, and the length of any waiting list. Only the federal government has access to this sort of comprehensive data. At present, only limited local data is provided by the government through the Childcare Access Line. Some leading private providers of childcare are doing this within their own networks, and some local authorities are doing the same. But we need a solution for all the nation's families, not just some. Knowing whether there are childcare places available for their children is one thing. Affording those places is another. At the household level, the equation is simple. What is my take-home pay after tax and childcare costs are deducted? Parents aren't mugs. They want to work, but they don't want to work for free. The financial burden of childcare has been rising and has been affected by two factors. One, the rising costs of childcare in itself. For each of the last 4 years, childcare out-of-pocket costs have increased by more than 12% each year. Over the life of the current government, parents' out-of-pocket childcare costs have doubled. This represents increases of nearly five times the rate of inflation. Two, the higher use of childcare by families as they struggle to keep up with the demands of workplaces and the growing mortgages and general cost of living expenses. The proportion of families with children under 12 who now purchase formal childcare each week has risen sharply by over 60% since 1996, and the average amount of time individual children spend in care each week has also increased. They use it more and it costs more. It all adds up to a rising financial burden for working Australian families. Government childcare policy to date has largely focused on the demand side. The childcare benefit provides an important supplement to working families to assist in the purchase of childcare. The more recent addition of a childcare tax rebate, which allows families to claim up to $4,000 in childcare out-of-pocket costs each financial year, is also a valuable assistance to parents. However, these measures alone have failed to adequately address the twin problems of supply and affordability. The government's decision to give one-off increase in the rate of childcare benefit to parents with no reforms to address the supply of childcare has in some cases already been swallowed up by price increases. In my home state of Queensland, it was recently reported that some centres were increasing fees by 25%, with the rates charged for babies up from $52 to $65 per day. One centre in suburban Brisbane wrote to parents recently to explain their decision to apply a 10% fee increase from the 1st of July and directly referenced the childcare benefit increase as the basis for their decision. Federal Labor has a different approach to childcare. Labor pioneered the use of demand-side fee relief But we have also embraced supply-side responses as well, particularly when that investment leverages the dividend of higher workforce participation. Labor has plans to develop up to 260 new childcare centres on school sites across the country to provide convenient childcare places in areas where there are shortages, as a practical measure to address parents' concerns about the double drop-off, reducing waiting lists for childcare centres, and putting some downward pressure on prices. Labor's policy of universal preschool for all four-year-olds will significantly increase the available places for four-year-olds and the educational quality of the care that they receive. Moreover, to further improve the quality of childcare, I've announced plans to invest in providing more qualified teachers in both private and community-based centres, recognising the fact that passing on the cost of improving the quality of education and care for our 250,000 four-year-olds to operators would only increase fees for parents. What this means are those children who typically spend a day in long day care will have on-site access to a structured preschool program within that day for all four-year-olds across Australia, whatever the form of delivery of the preschool arrangement might be. Non-working parents will have the choice of accessing a standalone preschool to utilise a long day care centre for preschool classes or other forms of delivery as well. To deal with the skill shortages in the area, as part of our $450 million commitment to universal preschool, I've announced an extra 1,500 university places each year for early childhood educators. And to get these educators working in areas of specific need, a Labor government will pay half the HECS payments of 10,000 early childhood graduates who work in these areas of need. More broadly, Labor wants to lift the qualification levels of the childcare workforce and will pay the TAFE fees for diploma-level childcare trainees. And today I wish to announce another practical step in both our childcare platform and for a fairer deal for families, one which I touched on earlier. If we're elected to form the next government of Australia, we will create an Office of Work and Family within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. I believe a Prime Minister should have direct involvement in the formulation of policies to get the balance right between work and families for all Australians. If elected Prime Minister, I want to take a central role in helping Australians get that balance right between time at work and time at home with kids. It was Mr. Howard who said 4 years ago that work-family balance was the barbecue stopper for Australia. Since then, it's become worse. And I have news for the Prime Minister. It's no longer a barbecue stopper. These days, families don't even have enough time to have barbecues together. As a first step, the Office of Work and Family will drive a comprehensive response to Australia's childcare crisis for working families. The Office of Work and Family will work with the states and territories and childcare providers to provide parents with reliable information on local childcare fees, vacancy data and parental reviews so parents are better informed about quality and price. Second, to publish breaches by childcare providers of the quality and accreditation standards which may occur in individual centres. Third, require childcare providers to give at least 2 months' notice to parents of childcare fee increases. And four, examine options to improve childcare affordability, including increasing workplace-based childcare so that parents can be closer to their children. Together with our supply-side measures, the aim of the Office of Work and Family will be to keep downward pressure being applied on fees. While these proposals represent both a serious financial commitment and an investment aimed at improving the supply of affordable quality childcare, I do not pretend that this is enough. It is time to begin a serious national debate on the range of childcare options for the future. Let me share with you three areas often raised with me in discussions on childcare, which the nation now needs to properly debate. First, a new expanded model of outside school hours care. Our Universal Preschool Initiative recognises that in the future, education and childcare will not be considered as separate systems, given the potential for children to learn in a variety of formal and informal settings. To my mind, we must give some consideration to whether outside school hours care remains a childcare program, or if it is not better considered as an addition to the functions of our schools. particularly given that around 76% of before and after school hours care programs are co-located on school sites. In other words, should outside school hours care be integrated with after-school homework clubs, individualised literacy and numeracy intervention for children identified with having difficulties in diagnostic tests, as well as supervised after-school sports programs to tackle the challenge of childhood obesity? Could outside school hours care be extended to junior secondary school as well? In other words, has the time come to think beyond the square on how we best use school facilities between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m, not just for childcare, but for further expanding our children's educational opportunities? Second, work-based childcare. Many argue that more needs to be done to encourage greater work-based childcare and for businesses to take a greater interest in the childcare needs of their workers. It's not surprising this debate emerges given that many working parents actively seek childcare near their place of work because it affords them the opportunity to visit their children during breaks. And of course, particularly given a tight labour market, employers may seek to consider how best to retain workers by considering creative and flexible childcare options for their staff. In the current situation, unless childcare is provided on business premises for children under the age of 6, an employer is liable to pay fringe benefits tax at 46.5 cents on every dollar spent on childcare. This means in practice that only the larger employers can comply with FBT exemptions because opening a licensed centre for infants requires significant land or lease holdings and a large number of employees who have children under the age of 6. The question arises as to whether the tax system, particularly FBT, can play a greater role in encouraging work-based childcare or work-sponsored childcare places in nearby centres where employers may not be large enough to build or operate purpose-built centres. My challenge to Mr. Costello is to throw open the books and to make his Treasury officials available to cost and analyse options such as these. And while on this topic, more broadly, Mr. Howard should make Treasury officials available to the opposition on a confidential basis to analyse and cost all of our initiatives so that we can have a more fruitful discussion on policy alternatives. This model is applied in other democracies, including the Irish Republic, to the official opposition in periods prior to an election. It leads to more intelligent policy and political debate. Third, many parents raise the efficacy and adequacy of the two benefits, childcare benefit and childcare tax rebate, that they currently receive. Any discussion about improvements to these benefits should also include other family payments, such as the baby bonus and family tax benefit. In particular, we should be looking at how they assist families with cost of living pressures and enable them to balance their parenting responsibilities on the one hand and their careers on the other. To conclude, we, as the Alternative Government, are calling for a much broader economic debate, a debate about where our future prosperity will lie and where it will come from. The political purpose behind Mr. Howard's bogus debates on interest rates and unions is plain to see. These are designed as fear campaigns to deflect from the debate that Mr. Howard does not want to have on the drivers of our long-term prosperity, our prosperity once the mining boom is over. That is the real enduring economic debate for our future. The other debate Mr. Howard does not want to have is why today's prosperity still leaves so many working families struggling with ballooning mortgages, cost of living pressures, and the impact of work choices, the industrial relations law that dare not speak its name anymore. The truth is, there are not parallel universes in Australia. There is one, and that is occupied by Australia's hard-working families. Mr. Howard has lost touch with them, and we intend to give them voice. I thank you for your time.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.